Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, what leads a person to call themselves a radical homemaker? Well, when we're talking about farm-to-table issues, farm-to-table talk, you know, your eye goes to people across the country that are speaking out about food and farming and how foods are produced and care about it. And who better than somebody that's an actual farmer and has talked about all these things? And we have a special guest from upstate New York with me today, the radical homemaker, Shannon Hayes. Shannon, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks for having me on today.
Oh, I'm delighted to have you here. And actually, it was recommended to me that I should talk to you by somebody that others have heard of, Joel Salatin.
He and I have a long history. We've both been in this, we've been on the front lines for quite some time now, it seems.
Well, you know, when I got done with having a podcast with Joel recently, I said, you know, everybody likes to listen to the podcast when I have conversations with Joel. And I said, who else do you think I should be talking to? And you were one of the first people he came up with. And he said, you need to talk to Shannon. So you have to kind of take it from there, because he didn't tell me exactly what I need to be talking to you about. Knowing Joel, why do you think he suggested that I hand you a microphone?
Well, Joel and I have been in this movement, like I said, for a very long time, and I first came across his work and met him when I was a graduate student working on my PhD at Cornell University, and I was looking at sustainable agriculture and community development, and I was studying all kinds of things, you know, social theory and all sorts of articles written by academics with lots of words that I couldn't pronounce, and I was getting very, very frustrated. And then I came upon Joel's books. And at the same time, I am a third-generation family farmer. I wasn't sure I was going back to the farm at that point, but I had grown up on this farm in upstate New York, and I cared about it enough to take up this cause of sustainable farming when I went on to grad school. And so when I found Joel's stuff, I suddenly got very fed up with academia and felt like this was the relevant work that I needed to be studying. And so I went on and organized farmers and managed to complete my PhD and do enough in academia to get a diploma, and then promptly left. And I felt at that point in my life I was, in my late 20s, and I was married, and I had this fresh degree in my pocket, and my husband had a master's degree in environmental communications, and we looked at each other, and we felt like we had a choice that we could make. We felt that we could go on and get professional careers with these diplomas that we had. And the other choice that we had is we could walk our talk, and we could come back to the family farm and try to make a go of it. And it didn't take long for me to do the math. Joel may have mentioned to you, I don't know, I'm a dollars and cents kind of girl. And I sat down. My parents were all ready for me to go out and get that job with the pension and the insurance plan. But I started running the numbers on the employment opportunities. And the numbers, I looked at my husband and I both having full-time jobs. If both he and I were to be full-time employed, we would have to move away from upstate New York, move away from family. We would have to buy a home in a significantly more expensive neck of the woods. We were going to have two cars instead of one. I couldn't wear a simple pair of overalls and just keep changing my shirt and my underwear every day, so I was going to have a professional wardrobe. And we started adding up the costs of these professional wardrobes, the cars, the cost of living, the commuting, the cost of buying rather than growing our own food. And then we balanced that out against living in the cabin that was just up the road from my family farm and joining that farm. And at that time, the obvious choice was to take those professional careers because everyone believed you really couldn't make it on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't balance out. We added it all up, and we had no children at that time. And I realized that we would only come out after taxes and all the expenses were backed out of the two-career family, we would only come out $10,000 ahead of where we would be if we stayed home and made a go of it on the family farm.
Oh, that's incredible.
And, well, you know, it's funny. We're not always quick to do those balance sheets because the numbers looked so big. The salary mm-hmm. looked so big. But the cost of living on the other side was so much lower for $10,000, and I didn't have kids to put in daycare yet.
mm-hmm. That's
so,
right.
We decided that I called my father up, and my father was a college professor. He and my mother came through the farm crisis, and they made a go of it on the family farm by having jobs. So this was kind of what the norm was, but they had eventually retired because they really wanted to try to make this thing go. So they both took early retirements to try to make Sapbush Hollow Farm go. And I said, I want to come back to the farm. And he kind of gawped at that.
Mm-hmm.
And he couldn't believe that his daughter with a PhD was telling him this. And I said, look, we can't afford to work. The writing is on the wall. I don't know why anyone else is seeing this, but the writing is on the wall. We can't afford these jobs. The middle class doesn't exist. It's going to just cause us to have more economic trouble than if we come back and follow our hearts. And so Mom and Dad put their heads together, and the farm was not generating enough income to pay us anything to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that we could piece it together and still come out okay. So they said, all right, just don't take any money out of our pockets. And I think they gave us a salary of about $5,000, I believe. So we got a small salary. And, you know, what we figured out was we could make that go a long ways. We could make it go a long ways because I grew up in this northern foothills of the Appalachian mountain chain that is the north of the Catskill Mountains. And I grew up in Appalachian culture. So down in the valleys, people were commuting into Albany, New York, into the capital, and were professional and things like that. But up in the hills, people were living on just a couple $1,000s a year. And I was sort of the surrogate grandchild of a couple of farmers who lived on less than $12,000 a year and lived very well and had a valuable estate when they finally passed that they had never, ever had more than a few $1,000s a year to support. And what I had learned growing up was it took domestic skills. You needed to know how to mend things. You needed to know how to put up your vegetables and freeze your fruit or can your fruit, make your jelly. You needed to know how to cook. And you needed to know how to make yourself happy without having a lot of money. And I felt that those skills could leverage us and buy us the time we needed to grow this farm to be something viable. So that's the path that we started out on, and we started working with my parents at Sapbush Hollow and growing that business consciously. And while we were doing that, I started writing about grass-fed meat. I'm terribly sorry, a car just went by, and I'm up in the hills, and I have dogs barking.
Oh,
I'm very
that's
sorry
right.
about
I've
that.
I've got a dog. My dog's going to join in whenever it hears some other dog barking. It starts
it's
barking.
It's part of the local charm here, I'm afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I figured out that we could not afford to have these jobs, and we started working on the farm. And at the same time, I started writing about grass-fed meat, and I wanted people to start understanding the economics and the ecological and social implications of buying local grass-fed meat. And I felt that I could write some lovely papers about it, like an academic,
mm-hmm.
but I didn't think it was going to cause the change that I wanted.
Let me pause yeah. just a second because mm-hmm. Because I'm still just amazed at the journey you've described so far. I think we have to slow down a second and absorb it because I really appreciate the fact that you came from an area that you had a farm, you had some back there you could come back to, but then go off and got a PhD. I mean, you decided in your PhD it was sustainability that you
Yes.
Got a PhD in?
Mm-hmm. Sustainable agriculture and community development.
Did that arm you to, as you came back and started setting things up on the farm, I mean, how did that education contribute to this whole game plan that you're just describing here?
So the intent of the education was to go get a job maybe at a land-grant university or something like that. But the more I studied, the more I realized what a gold mine I was sitting on.
Mm-hmm.
That if I was going to go teach other people in other parts of the country and the world that agriculture was important and it mattered for the sustainability of rural America, well, by golly, why not walk that talk and live that life? If farming was so important, then teaching about it wasn't as important as doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how you made the point.
Well, and then the other thing is that where you are, up in upstate New York, different than around me. I'm in California, and so, you know, we've got something that grows pretty much year-round where we are. What I think of when I think of your territory is a lot of great pasture land.
It is. It's rocky and hilly. I'm at about, well, my cabin here is at 2,000 feet elevation. The farm is just a little bit lower than that. Climate change has caused some changes, but it used to be we saw frost 11 months out of the year.
Wow.
So, yeah, pasture is the way to go. Backyard garden where you can throw, it's got to be small enough to throw sheets over it. The vegetarian lifestyle is it's not real feasible high in these hills, I'm afraid.
And so you decided from the outset when you were going back there that you were going to be doing something with ruminant animals then. You're going to have to be considering you're either going to do sheep or cows or goats, right?
Exactly. On hills like this, that's what you have to do to be safe. You're not going to do any kind of crop farming. You know, tractors roll over on people around here with, you know, if you're working on the hills with tractors.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to be doing that. You need to let the ruminants harvest the grass for you.
Now, is it all cattle or do you do sheep or goats?
I'm sorry that your phone just kind of cut out a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. I said, is it all cattle, or do you do sheep or goats, too?
We do lamb and beef and pork and pastured turkeys and Thanksgiving turkeys and pastured poultry, chickens, yeah. And then we also do the value-added products. So we process the wool into all-natural wool comforters, and we have it made into blankets and yarn. And then we take the animal fats and we process those, render them, and so we make salves and soaps and lip balms and candles from the animal fats.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also have a farm-to-table cafe where we have really great direct-trade coffee in our community and once a week a farm-to-table meal.
I wish you were closer to where I am because I'd love to come by. Now, the pork... you've got to give them some grain, too. They're not going to be able to get by just on the grass.
Right. Pigs are omnivores, so they require a mix. But the more you pasture them, the less grain they need.
Mm. Are you able to raise your grain, or do you have to buy most of the grain for the pigs?
We buy it locally, but, yeah, these fields will not allow that.
Yeah. Okay, so I interrupted you a few minutes ago because you were starting to talk about writing about...
I was noticing... I was starting to communicate with people. I was working more and more at the front lines with the customers, and I wanted to try to bring more people into understanding this grass-fed movement. And rather than writing articles about the importance of grass-fed, I realized from talking to my customers that why don't I talk to people about how to cook first, and then talk about the ethics and the sustainability between the lines in the recipes.
Mm-hmm.
So I had things to say, important academic things to say that I knew about grass-fed farming, but I tucked them in the pages of recipes, and I wrote the first grass-fed meat cookbook called the Grass-Fed Gourmet Cookbook, which sort of became a bit of a text for the movement, and started teaching by way of recipes. And as I was teaching by way of these recipes, I would get invited to conferences and asked to talk about the grass-fed movement. And I would repeatedly get asked to explain why it's so expensive and how we expect people to afford it and how we're going to make it cheaper and I was also repeatedly hearing at these conferences advice given to farmers that if you want to sell your product, you need to find wealthy communities. Now, Sapbush Hollow was in a growth phase, and I was getting to know our customers very well, and we were doing okay. You know, we weren't getting rich, but we were paying the bills, and it seemed very odd to me to keep hearing, oh, find the rich communities, find the rich towns, because we were having a totally different experience. In fact, we started noticing at our farmer's market that the more expensive jewelry someone was wearing, the less likely they were to buy our products. So it was a strange phenomenon. The experts were telling the farmers to go find rich downtown neighborhoods, and Bob and I would actually, if it was a really hot day and we saw people coming with lots of diamonds, we covered up the booth. We didn't even bother uncovering it because we said, with all those rocks on their fingers, they are not interested in paying for meat. They have other priorities. And we started looking at our customers and studying them very carefully and realizing the ones that laid down money and they never gave us sass about asking for a fair price for our food were the people who worked just as hard as we did. That's who paid for your product, because they understand hard work. And what we started realizing was part of that hard work was they had domestic skills. Namely, they knew how to cook. And not only did these people know how to cook, but you started realizing, you know, they knew how to fix their car, they knew how to fix, you know, if something was breaking in the house, they knew how to fix that. And so I was asked to speak one time at the American Dietetic Association, big conference. I don't know, there's thousands and thousands of people, of attendees at this conference, and they wanted me to say, what is this grass-fed movement, and why won't it go away? And, you know, and how do we expect people to afford such expensive food again? And so I stood up there in this conference. I thought and thought and thought, how am I going to answer this question? I was so scared because I realized the way people were going to afford this food was by reclaiming domestic skills, which meant you had to bring back the home cook. Now, I'm coming from the generation, my mother was the generation that went to work. They tried to break the glass ceiling. They, you know, it was all about going to work. And why do I have a PhD? Because as a liberated woman, you go out and you get your education and you have a career.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I understood about sustainable farming, the more I realized we're not going to revive the land, we're not going to revive our communities unless someone is at home. We can't be having two career families and saving the planet, saving rural America, and saving our health. We have to put somebody in the kitchen, because when you have domestic skills, you can economically afford to pay someone a fair price for the food and then economically use it in a resourceful way. You can take a chicken. You can roast the chicken for dinner. You can pull off the excess chicken and make a chicken salad. You can take the carcass. You can boil that. You can make chicken soup. One chicken is not one dinner for a family of four. One chicken should be a minimum of three dinners for a family of four. You should be able to get 12 meals from a chicken. That's simple, basic home economics, and I realized those are the skills that we are losing. And I was so scared because I am a feminist, and I believe in the balance of power, and yet I was looking at this issue of domestic skills and felt like there was a big gap and there was a big problem that we had completely stepped away from. In putting everyone in the family into the workforce, we had given the processed food industry free rein over our soils, over our communities, over the health of our children, over the health of ourselves, and it was dangerous. So it was a tricky walk that I had to walk, and I introduced this idea there and was shocked out of my mind at how well received it was. And from there, I began researching and interviewing families across the country who were able to live on a single income or less and still adhere to their social values of environment, local economy, healthy community, and healthy families.
Well, I assume as a feminist, you don't care which one of them is
exactly
out there with the single job.
I don't care, but someone better be keeping the home fire burning. Mm-hmm. Or what I interviewed both men and women who were doing this when I wrote the book Radical Homemakers. And then that PhD that we talked about a while back that I said, oh, I don't have any use for that. Well, that came in pretty heavy. It was a pretty intensely researched project. And then I started realizing the part of the problem is that we don't have someone at home, but also it's with the American workforce that we do not allow people to have jobs and honor those four tenets of environment, economy, community, and health. We expect too much out of them. We expect them to give everything to the workplace so that they can't get home and cook. They can't have quality time with their family. They can't volunteer in their communities. They can't take the time to recycle, to repair, to reuse things because they're running so hard to keep up with the work. So that's where the whole radical homemaking movement stemmed from. And that book came out in 2010, and I've been working with it since then and continuing to make my merry way along with writing more cookbooks, writing more essays, writing essay books, and then, of course, working with Sapbush Hollow Farm to grow that business so that my daughters can also be independently employed in not have to worry about running to a job that doesn't respect their need to take care of family and community and the environment.
Well, I think it's a great story. I understand why you were come up with radical, though, because it's, in some respects, it shouldn't be radical, but it is compared to what the conventional wisdom has been or what the politically correct view has been in recent years. So you're kind of radical. But one piece I want to go back to, and that is that when you're raising the livestock, one of the problems across the country is that there's no place left that you can have livestock slaughtered. I know many people that would like to have a flock of sheep or have some cattle, and it used to be every town had
an abattoir?
You know, you go to the locker and the meat locker, and they would, and you could bring them in a, you know, a couple cattle, or you could bring them in some pigs, because I grew up on a farm too. But I think almost all of those were out of business. I mean, how do you find some place to process the livestock that you're growing?
Well, I have to tell you, it's been very interesting, because we had that problem several years ago, where, you know, we just had very, very few options. And those options that were available, the butcher always took his cut before, and then charged you on top of that. And there were some real cultural problems. And we've been in the business a long time, and my family did not commit just to farming. You can't commit to a business that's tied to the land without committing to the community. And we've invested a lot into building infrastructure in this community. we've done things like we have a cutting room on the farm that we did, but we've also done a number of personal loans to butchers that have worked with us on the farm and then gone out and started their own businesses. We have worked to build with a couple other farms something called the Northeast Livestock Processing Service Company that goes out and helps farmers to coordinate with other processors and helps the meat processors adhere to the standards and oversees that process and audits that process to make sure things aren't stolen, to make sure things are done correctly, that we meet certain industry standards, and we created those industry standards. So, you know, as I said, Joel and I have been in the business for a long time, and you can't just go into this farming thing and say, I'm going to live alone on my mountain or in my valley or on my fields and just grow food and just live and not talk to anybody. You know, a commitment to a farm is a commitment to a community and to creating the infrastructure so that others can follow and so that the children that you hope someday will take over can have it easier than maybe we did. And well, that's been as serious work as cutting the pork chops and making the sausages.
Oh, man, that sounds really impressive. And then you have hides and you've got wool and you've got all these byproducts that you have to find a home for. I would imagine we could have a number of podcasts just talking about all of what you have to do to make it balance. But let me just go to the end of the line here. Where are you marketing some of the product? You said you do have the cafe, but
right.
how does the meat that you grow end up being purchased by consumers?
We have only two outlets. We have a farmer's market that we go to in Margaretville, New York. It's called the Round Barn Market, and it's in the Catskills, and it's beautiful, beautiful, one of the oldest farmer's markets in New York State. And my family has held that booth for over, is it now up to 25, almost 30 years? I don't know. It's getting to be a long time. And we also have this cafe, which is also our farm store. We, again, as I mentioned, the farm is part of the community, so we used to sell directly off the farm, but when we realized we'd outgrown the space, we decided not to build a store on farm. Our little community is trying to revive itself and come back, and so instead of putting our farm store on the farm, which is, you know, kind of back off the road a ways, we bought our old firehouse and post office in the community, and we kept the post office because there had been attempts to close it, so we made a commitment to that building and keeping that as operational, and we took the old firehouse and we made that into the farm store and community, so it's right in the heart of this little teeny tiny rural hamlet, and so that the people in that hamlet have a place to go, and, you know, they can walk in if they want to buy meat from us, they can buy meat, but if they just want a, you know, a $2 cup of coffee and to sit down with neighbors, they can do that. But it's created a community space as well as a place for us to sell our farm products. And that has caused our business to take another leap by having that space available. And so, yeah, location, location, location.
Is it usually,
but those are our two outlets.
Yeah. Now, is the meat usually frozen?
Yes. Yes, we sell frozen meat. And then once a month throughout the growing season, we do have fresh chickens available. And then as we harvest animals, as if we harvest a beef, we might have fresh beef that weekend. Or, you know, we might have fresh lamb as it times out. But we really put an emphasis on educating our customers about frozen meat. That, you know, a lot of the stuff you get in the grocery store, you think it's fresh because it's not frozen. But just because they've held it for several weeks at that temperature doesn't really mean anything. And so we work at educating our customers that a frozen product is every bit as good.
Well, I think sometimes a lot better because you're starting with a seasonal production system. And it just ties, especially the lambs and a little bit the beef as well. But certainly, I mean, when they're grazing and when they're reaching peak condition off of roughage, you know, freezing keeps it at that peak condition available for people rather than just figuring that there's 2 months a year that they're going to get the best quality.
Exactly, exactly.
And I think it's a tremendous, tremendous story. Well, this in wrapping up, a couple things. I'm going to have you tell people where they can find you on the website. But what's you've accomplished so much now. I mean, what are you hoping for? What are some of the things that you get excited about in a positive way, maybe optimistic about when you look in this year ahead?
Well, actually, my husband and I always worked with my family farm, but I'm part of a multi-generational family, and so this is the first year where we have done the farm transition, which I know is so hard for farm families, and I could talk to you for hours about what it takes to work out a farm transition plan. And so the reins are now officially turned over to me. For many, many years, I just worked to help market the farm, but now I am the manager of Sapbush Hollow, and it's a full partnership between all of us. So that's pretty exciting because I'm taking this farm and, you know, something that my parents did sort of at a subsistence level, and I've been working a lot of years to grow it, but now I can hold the reins and do that myself and try to grow it so that there's room for my daughters to come into the business. I love that idea. I love this cafe. I love what that does for the community. But, you know, I'm also still a writer, and I am in the process this winter. I have a blog, but every winter I stop blogging, and I write quietly in retreat in my house without publishing anything. And I've been working for several years on a novel and autobiographical fiction about coming through the farm crisis and the history in these hills. And so that's my private joy that I would love to say I'll wrap it up this year, but, you know, it's going on for 3 years. Maybe it'll go on for another one because I'm a busy lady.
You are a busy lady. Well, I am going to ask you one other thing, though, too.
Sure.
And that is, what about somebody that might be listening to this podcast and they've just thought, gee, I wish I could do this, and maybe they're in a job that's not going quite like they'd like it to, but what their dream would be is if they could be kind of more like you. I mean, what's the first thing they should do? Somebody was thinking, I'd like to try to figure out how I could make a living back on a farm. What advice would you have for them?
Go for what excites you the most first.
Hmm.
Don't try to do all of it. I hear stories of, now, I'm 42 years old, and I've been doing it for a long time, but I hear stories of other people who are my age or younger getting into this, and they want to have it all at once. They want to have the farm, they want to have the on-farm cutting facility, they want to have the farm-to-table restaurant, they want to have the cafe, they want to have all the value-added products, so they want to have a slick marketing program, and you can't. You'll kill yourself. You'll kill yourself. It's too hard. I get to have all these things because my parents started with the farm, and they brought the farm into the black, and then I was able to take the next steps. I am a product of multiple generations. My grandparents farmed, my parents farmed, and I farm. And so each generation can bring in building blocks. And sometimes you can do that more and faster if you're able to, you know, handle employees and have a big business plan and be really good at your marketing. But I think for a lot of people who are drawn to the agrarian life, you need to start smaller. You need to start with the farm, with getting involved with your community, maybe with feeding yourself, or start raising the things that make your heart sing the most.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe it's the honeybees. Maybe it's something as simple as keep your job, but put honeybees in your backyard and start with the homemaking side of it, with making your life more affordable so that one of you, if you're in a couple situation, so that one of you can afford to leave. Because what I did learn was the more domestic skills you had, then you usually one person could afford to leave. And then that person, with all the families I interviewed, I learned that that person then had the ability to start building the bridge to the new economy, to start leaving the extractive economy and start building this life-serving economy, if you will, where they had the domestic skills to bring down the cost of living so they could live on less, and then that person could start building the farm business or start building whatever independent business it is that they want that enables the couple to eventually be job-free and be self-employed. So you can transition that way as well.
Well, that's great advice. I'm getting excited. I'm going to go out and get some goats or something.
There you go.
And so if somebody wants to find out more what you do or recipes or find your book, where do they look?
TheRadicalHomemaker.net. TheRadicalHomemaker.net. And on there, they can sign up to get what's something that's called the Tuesday Post, where every Tuesday I'll send a new recipe and a new story about life on the farm into their inbox. But that newsletter is quiet right now until the growing season starts. Like I said, I work on my books in the wintertime, and then I do blogging essays from May through Thanksgiving. You can get the stories then and follow what's happening weekly that way.
Well,
and we have people from all over the world who subscribe to that. So you don't have to be, you know, a local customer to enjoy that. And you can also see some of our farm products that are non-perishable on that site as well.
Well, and now you can tell people they can listen to you on Farm to Table Talk, too.
There you go. And listen to me on Farm to Table Talk.
That's it. That's it. Shannon, thanks so much. If you're a radical homemaker, we need more radicals. So thanks for being on Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks for taking the time with me today. Have a great afternoon.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson. If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating. Thanks for listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.